I offer my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. And as always, I pray to Swami to give us all the understanding that He alone is the one who speaks, He alone is the one who listens. Elders, sisters and brothers, Sai Ram to all of you. Most of you would have read the topic for the day. It's got to do something with love. Many times people come and tell me, it's almost a complaint, a charge, that I tend to intellectualize whatever I speak about. I think it's a charge I should humbly accept. It's true. But how do we intellectualize a concept like love? What is the necessity to intellectualize a concept like love? As we all know, we clearly differentiate that love springs from the heart, while reasoning, understanding, comes from the mind. So how do we and why do we use our mind to understand something which is deeper than the mind? Many times Swami tells a beautiful saying. It's very cryptic, like most other sayings of Swami. It has layers and layers of meaning. Swami says, you are not one, but three. I'm sure we all would have heard this saying from Swami many, many times. You're not one but three. Just a little aside, whenever I read this saying, I'm reminded of an incident which happened when we were studying in Vrindavan. There were two youngsters who came from Europe, and these two were princes of a certain kingdom. So Swami was taking care of them very fondly, and Swami was looking after their hospitality. I remember when they were in Vrindavan, there was a drama staged by children from Singapore. And the drama was scripted in such a way that throughout the drama, there would be an elderly grandfather who would keep quoting Swami without naming Swami. And towards the end of the drama, he would say, the source of all my wisdom is Bhagwan Shri Sathya Sai Baba. I mean, it's like the climax of that entire drama. And I remember in the drama, he made the statement, there is a great a Mahatma who says, you are not one but three. The one you think you are, which is the body. The one which others think you are, which is the mind. And the one you really are. The moment this line came in the drama, Swami turned to these youngsters and like a little child, Swami said, it's my coat, it's my coat. Swami said, it's mine, I only said it. That apart, that's the beauty of our Lord, so childish yet so profound. But this statement is so very beautiful and so very true. The body, we all know, it is obvious. When I see all of you, I am seeing the bodies. When you see me, you see me, see a body sitting here. So the body is the most obvious thing. It can be seen, it can be felt, it can be using all the rules of investigation of science. It can be, its presence can be ascertained. But the body is the most obvious. And the Vedanta says, mind, you can fix the presence of the mind with a little bit of logic. Right? With a little bit of logic. You need a mind to do your day-to-day activities. So there must be something like a mind, even though it cannot be seen. And when I say mind, it is not the brain. The brain is again a physical entity. Because when a person is dead, the brain is still there. What activates the brain seems to have vanished. At least from that body. So the mind, the presence of the mind can also be deciphered. But the Vedanta says that the most subtle is the real self, the Atma, the soul, or whatever we would like to call it. But the beauty of this body is we go on thinking that we are this body. We all use LPG gas at home, the liquefied petroleum gas. In science we learn that, in school science we learn, that actually natural gas has no odor. But when we have a gas leak in the house, we all get the odor, right? and we believe that the gas is leaking. Actually, they add a substance while packaging LPG, it's called ethyl mercaptan, which gives the odor to the odorless gas. It's got nothing to do with the natural gas. It is added so that when it leaks, we will be able to identify it. But we are so accustomed to that smell that we think that the smell belongs to the gas. We look at this body, I look at you, you look at me. We get so accustomed to addressing the body, we get into the belief that we are the body, you are the body. But the body is given so that I can't talk to thin air, right? If none of you were embodied, even if I were not embodied, who would talk, who would listen? So it's almost a representation, just like that mercaptan, ethyl mercaptan is put into the odorless gas so that when there is a gas leak, we will be able to identify it. Almost in that sense, the body is given as an apparatus to identify your being, but you are not the body. Now we are left to the mind and the soul. Before the mind, let's go straight to the soul, because we're going to talk about love and the source of love. When I say love, I mean pure love is the purest part of us. And as Krishna would say in the Bhagavad Gita, he says, Mamaivamsho Jivaloke. He says that my spark, the purest part of me, as an amsha, is in each living being. And that's what we come to call the soul, the atma. You can either think it is a spark. The Advaitins believe that there is no difference between this and that. Some people believe that this is a small version of that. And some people believe that this is journeying towards that. And different schools of belief. But we all believe that all of us have a very, very pure core. And this love actually emanates from that core. And this love by nature is pure. It has no impurities. When I say that, that's why Swami would say, Prem Ishwar hai, Ishwar Prem hai. God is love, love is God. Love is not a quality of this core inside. This core itself is love. Again, we have not addressed the issue of why we have to intellectualize what love is. There is this classic Vedantic example. You know, the mirror is often referred to, the mind is often compared to the mirror. Right? It's a very interesting analogy, very, very deeply thought out analogy. It says the mind is similar to the mirror. So who looks at the mirror? Who stands before the mirror and who looks at the mirror? If we study, it says that that real self stands in front of the mirror. Who sees the mirror? Everybody around. So what I see of you is your mind mirroring the divinity within. So I'm every time actually looking at your mind, you're all looking at my mind. And this mind is given to certain impurities, certain aberrations, certain flaws. And Swami has very beautifully described, it's not a new concept, it's the three flaws in the mind. It's called mala, vikshepa and avarna. It's not new, most of you would be familiar with these words. Where mala is, Swami says, an impurity on the surface of the mirror. When you have a mirror, there is a layer of dust. We cannot see ourselves clearly, isn't it? Let's say there's a mirror lying in the attic for many decades, and we go in front of the mirror, even though it's a mirror, it doesn't mirror. Why? Because there's a thick layer of dust over it. Swami says, this is mala, and this can be compared to the memories which keep collected in the mind over several births. Why some of us have certain fears? Some of us might have an exaggerated fear about fire. Some of us might have an exaggerated fear about heights. There is no reason to have a particular fear like that, but it might be some reason in the past which keeps collected. Swami says that is mala. And the second Swami says is vikshepa. This mirror has the tendency to keep wavering like that. Can a wavering mirror be used as a mirror? You cannot see yourself clearly, isn't it? So the wavering nature of the mind is called vikshepa, and avarana is the ultimate. If you put a cloth over the mirror can be clean, the mirror can be stable, but if you put a cloth over the mirror, it's of no use. And Swami says that cloth is wrong identification. You completely believe that you're not this divinity within. And whenever Swami said you're not one but three, the one you think you are is the body, and the one that others think that you are is the mind. I always used to get confused. Shouldn't this be the other way around? Shouldn't it be that the one who I think I am is the mind, and the one who others think I am is the body? But this is how it is, because the mirror, which is our mind, reflects what is inside, and everybody is looking at the mirror. So what happens in the case of a Jivan Mukta? We call a person who is a Jivan Mukta. Even a Jivan Mukta, let us say a realized soul is here, again we still are only looking at his mind. We are not looking at his soul. We are only looking at his mind. Only the difference is, now that mind perfectly mirrors the divinity within. Now that mind perfectly mirrors that love within. Now that mind perfectly mirrors that selflessness within. So going by this analogy, each one of us is capable of perfectly loving. Each one of us are perfectly capable of sacrifice and selflessness of the order that Swami embodied. But it is this mind which has the tendency to reflect a flawed image of what is inside. Now going back to why do we need to intellectualize something like love? Because all that we are doing is only with the mind. The love within is always perfect. You cannot perfect it. What we are trying to do is try to teach the mind that look, this is the quality of love, so that it can perfectly mirror that love within. There is this wonderful speaker, Anthony DeMello, writer. I've quoted his stories before. He says this wonderful example. He says, I'm sitting here. What should I do to see? What should I do? What action should I perform to see? Nothing. I don't have to do anything. Sight is always there. I'm seeing all of you, right? I don't have to do anything to see you. Sight is always existent. But suppose if an object comes in between, suppose an object comes here, all I have to do is remove that obstruction, right? And that's why it is said, when vision is unobstructed, sight is there. You don't have to do anything, there's nothing to be done. When the eye is unobstructed, the result is sight. When the heart is unobstructed, the result is love. This is his very beautiful quote. You know, when the eye is unobstructed, the result is sight. Similarly, when the heart or the soul or the innermost pure core in us, when that is unobstructed, the result is love. So there are two ways of doing it. As I said, the mind is the mirror which reflects the love inside. Either you teach the mind to imitate your heart. Either you teach the mind to imitate your heart, and it is believed that as a spiritual practice, this actually negates the mind altogether. Either you teach the mind to imitate the heart, or you remove the mind from the picture. As Swami beautifully gives in another example, 3 minus 1 in mathematics is 2. But in spirituality, 3 minus 1 is 1. You have this mirror, you have the soul, you have the observer. You remove any one of this, only one is left. So either you train your mind to imitate your heart, or you remove the mind altogether. Let's come to the topic of the day, which is love. Till now I just said, why do we need to intellectualize love? But What is love after all? It's a very complex feeling. I remember seeing a 10-minute video sometime back where a number of people from different age groups, from toddlers to 90-year-olds, married, unmarried, bachelors, you know, saints, sages, they were all asked on camera, what is love? And almost nobody is able to define it. They're all able to give references to love, but nobody is able to define love, and that's the nature of love itself. But nevertheless, we all feel love. Let's start with love for an object. Let's say an object or a habit. You love something. You love doing something. Let's take probably the most harmless addiction, let's say. Let's say somebody has love for tea or coffee. Right? I love coffee or I love tea. What does that practically mean when I say I love something like that? If I break it down, point number one, I feel happy when I have it, right? When I get to have it, I feel happy. Point number two, when I don't have it, I feel restless. You deny me my morning coffee, you deny me my afternoon tea, some restlessness sets in. And the third thing is, sometimes I don't mind giving up something else for this. You know that having coffee or tea late in the evening might spoil your dinner's appetite, but still you don't mind. He said, no problem, I love coffee more than my dinner. So what are the three things that we do? I feel happy when it is with me. I feel restless when it is taken away from me. And I put it higher in my list of priority. I tend to prioritize it over others. It doesn't mean I don't love anything else, but this I prefer more than that. Right? This is when it is about an object. Now things get very complicated when you put a person there. Isn't it? When you put a person there, now the same things apply, the same three things. I feel happy when that person is with me. I feel restless when that person is taken away, or even if the scare of that person moving away comes. Right? That's restlessness. And the third thing is prioritization. I prioritize that person's happiness other than all others' happiness, above my own happiness. But still, when you love an object, the three qualities I said, when you love an object, is called objectification. Right? Objectification. When you love towards something, you treat the person whom you're loving like an object. It's called objectification. And a love which is objectification is actually suffocating. You don't let that person go anywhere. You're possessive. Right? But then, this prioritization actually helps. Say, I love so-and-so X. Now, that person's happiness takes a little higher priority than my own happiness. I like doing something, but if you like doing something else, I'm ready to do what you like to do. I'm ready to put down what I like and do what you like because I prioritize your happiness above mine. Of course, you can't do that with coffee, right? You don't go and ask coffee, what do you feel like doing today? There is no choice for that which you love in, and it's an object. But when it's a person, that person's feelings, that person's likes, that person's wants and desires, you expand your love to accommodate that. That is when your love for a person transcends objectification. So when at a point in time when you say that whatever I do it only for your happiness. There is no trace of my happiness in it. I do it only for your happiness. Probably that's when interpersonal love becomes pure enough to be called pure. I'm not saying it is the purest, but pure enough to be called pure. But let us say I love X. Because I love X, that person's happiness is priority for me. So I make that person happy. I do all that it takes to make that person happy. And when that person is happy, I am happy. Right? That's what happens in interpersonal love. I make that person happy because when I see that person happy, I'm happy. If I see you depressed, I become depressed. So am I making you happy only so that I can be happy? Is that selfishness or selflessness? I'm trying to be happy. For me to be happy, I have to make you happy. So let me make you happy. Semi-selfishness, that's probably the right way to put it. Because the difference is, now I make that person happy and I derive my happiness from that person's happiness. Though I am doing it from my own happiness, I derive my happiness from that person's happiness. I am not saying, I want to be happy, so let me make you happy. It's a very, very subtle difference, isn't it? I derive my happiness when you are happy. So there's a very subtle difference. Probably this is where we, one step this side, one step that side, one step this side, one step that side, in interpersonal love. Why is it so? Because we all are imperfect. We all are imperfect. When I am being the object of some person's love, I am not responding in the ideal way, isn't it? I have my own preferences, all said and done. This is how I want love to be showered on me. When the object of your love is not perfect, there is a chance that your love does not have the scope to see perfection. We spoke about love that arises from the heart, saying that that is perfect. I have not yet described what is that perfection. But then we say that the love which arises from the mind, that is what we called affection and attachment. It's not love, it's affection. Unfortunately, in the English language, everything is called love. Love is a universal word. But if you see in the local languages, you see in Telugu, Kannada, Tamil, there is always a differentiation between love in its purest form and interpersonal love. For instance, in Telugu, you have Preeti and Prema. It's always the differentiation is there. Even in Kannada, it's Preeti and Prema. The love that is purest, your Prema can take the form of Preeti, but Preeti and Prema are different. Now, how is it that the love which is reflected by the mind is impure? These are because of the two qualities of the mind, which are the inherent qualities of the mind. The mind is given for that purpose, right? Why are we given a mind? From the animal to the human being when we have come, when we have traveled, why have we given a mind? It has two roles to play. Among the many others, what are they? Self-preservation. The mind is supposed to take care of you. Self-preservation is one of the important functions or roles the mind plays. And the other is discrimination. In fact, discrimination is a tool that self-preservation uses. A simple example, let's say there is a mango. The mango has a very pleasant fragrance. The mango has a very pleasant color. The mango has a very pleasant taste. Why has nature created it like this? Because there are some ingredients, nutrients in that mango which is valuable for my health. So nature creates this thing where you automatically get attracted to that. So the mind is trained to say that this is pleasant odor, this is unpleasant odor. This is tasty, this is not tasty. So the mind discriminates between right and wrong, good and bad. The same mango, you keep it till it rots, the smell changes. The same mango which was giving a pleasant fragrance now gives a stench. You don't like that smell. The taste changes. The same object which was tasting better a few days back now tastes unpalatable. Why? Because it's the mind telling you that now that thing is not good for you. The mind is telling now it is not good for you. That's why Swami would often say that when there is a name for the senses in the scriptures, it's called matraha. Matraha means that which measures. An instrument which measures. Is it good? Is it not good? Is it healthy? It is not healthy. Don't ask me about bitter gourd. I don't know why it's not tasty but still good for us. Probably there are some exceptions. But I hope you get the idea. The mind has a nature of self-preservation. It automatically chooses what is right for me. What will protect me? What will help me live? The mind always tries to keep you alive. Why is that? Because, as Swami says, Jantu naam narajanma durlabham. Though the mind is stupid, somewhere in it is the knowledge, is the intelligence that this human birth is precious. This human birth has been obtained after much struggle. Jantu naam narajanma durlabham. Among all beings to be born a human is a special blessing. So the mind always tries to preserve life. And what is the problem when it tries to do that? It becomes selfish, isn't it? It always thinks about my happiness, my welfare, my well-being. So somewhere this comes in between when we try to love another person. Though I want to make you happy, though your happiness is what gives me happiness, somewhere I still hold on to my own happiness. I still hold on to my likes and dislikes. And what is the problem with this discriminating mind? The buddhi? Right and wrong, good and bad. Few years ago when Swami was talking to all of us in Trayi Vrindavan, somebody asked this question. They said, Swami, Rama followed whatever Dasharatha, his father, said. Should we also obey our father like that? Swami said, if you have a father like Dasharatha, you have to. Because Dasharatha was not an ordinary man. But otherwise, you know, Swami was once very, very beautifully, you know, that's how sweet Swami is. Once, just a week before we went out for vacation, Swami was talking to all of us and Swami said, see boys, the hostel is like a garage. You all are like cars which have come out of order. You have driven into the garage and I've taken so much pain to put you in order. I've taken all my time, I've spent so much of my energy, I've given you so much love. I repair this car. And every time vacation comes, I know what happens. I'm sending this car outside. So Swami said, remember this and try to come back to me just the way I sent you out. And once very beautifully, Swami said, you know, you look, when you go home, you will not like the company of your old friends. Because your tastes have changed. After living with Swami, your tastes have changed. You would like to spend more time in silence. You would like to spend more time in reading. But your old friends will come back. And they will say, come on, let's go out. Let's go for a movie. Let's go for a dinner. And your parents will feel, why is this boy so dull? Why is this girl so dull? So your parents will come up to you and tell, why don't you go out? Just go see a movie and come. Swami would say, see, their idea is that you should be happy. But they don't know what is right and wrong. They don't have the privilege that you have had of being in Swami's presence and knowing what is right and wrong. But the intention is good. They just want you to be happy. So you have to explain to them that no, this is not what Swami expects of us in a very loving manner. That's what Swami had told. But what Swami was pointing out was that even if I love you, I tend to superimpose my idea of what is right and wrong, what is good and unpleasant, what can make a person happy and unhappy, on the person I love, isn't it? So this discrimination of the mind, which is used for self-preservation, actually becomes a hurdle in expressing pure love. Because all the time I'm superimposing what I believe is right and wrong on you. It may not be true. This happens very often with parents. Parents say, you have to become an engineer, you have to become a doctor. Their ideas, intentions are pure because they want to see their child flourish in life. But all the time when you're superimposing what you think is right and wrong, there is a chance of that love being imperfect. Now this is all when you love a person. What happens when the object of love is God? That's what we eventually all are bothered about. It's not about love for coffee or love for X, Y, or Z. As I said, when the object of your love is not perfect, your love loses the opportunity to perfect itself. I wouldn't say that it's impossible. It's definitely not impossible, but it becomes very difficult. Right? Suppose I want to do calligraphy. It's difficult to do it in a bumpy bus, isn't it? I need a stable place. Even if I'm trying to tie a shoelace, if I'm sitting in a vehicle which is going up and down, it would be difficult. You need stability. It reminds me of a joke which happened when we were students. We were doing a presentation on controlling the mind and stilling and stabilizing the mind. So it was a presentation, a class presentation, and in the course of that, I happened to give an analogy, which I said, you know, there is a psychological study which says, in fact, Swami also said this, that when you hold out your finger like this, your forefinger, you would see that it always shakes a little bit. You know, it's never stable. Even if you're really young, it's never stable. At least a little shake is there. And in a discourse, Swami actually said that this is actually a representation of your mind. Even the most stable of minds actually is not really stable. So in that analogy, I went on to say that now your finger is shaking. How do you stop that finger from shaking? Now when I put it on the table is stable. Now the finger also stops shaking, isn't it? So similarly, when the mind is always shaking, what is the best way to stabilize it? You put it on something which is stable. You place it on God. You do namasmarana. You give your mind to God. So this was the analogy. 3 days later, a classmate of mine walks up to me and he said, you know, that technique which you gave really worked for me. I said, what technique was that? I have not said any technique which worked for me. Which was the technique which worked for you? He said that putting the finger on the table. Said, yeah, what did you do? He said, now whenever my mind is unstable, I put my finger on the table. He said, whenever I feel that my mind is not stable, I put my finger on the table. Oh, if it really works, then why not? But the idea is this, when you want to perfect your love, when you direct this love towards something, whose love is perfect? You have a chance to perfect your own love. How does this happen? You know, initially when we go to God, I think it probably is right for almost all of us. I love my family. I love my parents. I love my friend, whatever. And if somebody is in danger, and I love myself, let's not forget that. That's, I think, first. If anybody in this circle of my love is in danger, I go to God. Why? Because I am happy only if all these people are happy, right? So my first step towards God is actually to protect these loved ones. It's not love towards God. It's actually love towards these people which is inspiring me to turn towards God, because it seems to be the best bet available. There are 10 people who can take care of these loved ones, but there is this one guy who can take care of them best. So let's turn it towards him. Right? Isn't that how we turn to the Lord? Because here is a built-in family doctor, family lawyer, family counselor. You don't have to run to different people. There's one person who can take care of all my problems. So when we first turn to God, we're actually turning to God because He can protect the ones whom we love, not because I love God. But then Swami gives us two tools which look so very simple that we lose to recognize the profundity of theirs. Two very simple tools Swami gives. Swami says, first thing, whatever Swami does for me is good for me. Okay, initially, we have clearly in our head, good health is good, bad health is bad, money is good, bankruptcy is bad. And it is with this discrimination we come to God. Because something goes wrong, God, please fix it. But then Swami introduces this concept. Try to tell yourself that whatever happens is good for you. Okay, that's new. Let's try it out. Whatever happens is good for me. And Swami says, also remember that God knows best. I mean, that's easy to understand. He has more wisdom than us, doesn't he? So God knows what is best, and whatever he does is good for me. Why are these two very important? Because we can never come across an individual in our life who fits these two descriptions. He knows absolutely what is right, man or woman. He is always thinking only about your good. You will never ever come across a person like this. Because every person is given to some amount of flaw, some amount of selfishness, some amount of mistake and discrimination. But you come in front of God, whose discrimination is perfect. He knows exactly what is right and wrong. He knows exactly what is good at what time. And he is completely concerned about you. So God knows best. Swami knows what is right. And at every time he is doing what is good for me. So Swami says, keep reminding yourself this. Keep reminding yourself. Keep reminding yourself. What happens when we keep reminding ourselves this? I have a health problem. I go to Swami. I say, Swami, I am having this health problem. Swami says, Manchidi. Chala santosham. The health problem remains. Now I again tell myself, whatever happens to me is good for me. So having a health problem is good for me. My discrimination expands. I'm doing a business. The business is going to collapse. I run to Swami. Swami, my business is on the rocks. Swami says, okay, no problem. So now I'm again telling myself, whatever happens is good for me, whatever happens is good for me. Now suddenly having a problem in business is good for me. My discrimination expands. So what happens is, my attachment to what is good suddenly seems to be withering away, because everything seems to be good. What is bad? So my idea of what is good and what is bad seems to be suddenly expanding. And what do we call this in spirituality? We call this vairagya. We call this detachment. Right? Isn't that what it is called? Because suddenly, today I am hungry, I don't mind. Tomorrow you give me a feast. Yeah, thank you. Day after tomorrow again I am hungry, I don't mind. Because whatever happens is good for me. Whatever happens is good for me. Whatever Swami sends to me is good for me. I keep repeating this again and again. So suddenly everything seems to be right. In the Bhagavad Gita, when Arjuna comes to Krishna and he says, he describes the mind, he says, Chanchalam Imanam Krishna. He says, the mind is always flickering, the mind is more difficult to control than the wild wind. The mind is always flickering, the mind is always on one object and then it goes on to the other object. What am I to do with this mind? You know, that's what he asks Krishna. And what does Krishna say? He says, yes, it's true. It's very difficult to control the mind. He says, Abhyasena tu Kaunteya Vairagyena cha Grihyate. There are two tools, Abhyasa and Vairagya. Abhyasa is practice. Vairagya is detachment. When you practice this thought, because the thought is only for the mind, it's not for the soul. As I said, the soul is perfect. The soul perfectly knows that whatever Swami does is good for me. But it is the mind which always gives options, isn't it? The conditioning is always in the mind. Conditions are always in the mind. So what you do, you practice in the mind. Whatever happens is good for me. Whatever happens is good for me. Abhyasena. It is through abhyasa, through practice. It does not come one day. It comes through practice. And what is this other quality of the mind? The mind stores, right? That is what we call the chitta aspect of the mind. It has a hard disk, which it keeps storing. So when you keep doing this, it happens over lifetimes. Whatever happens is good for me. Whatever happens is good for me. If my Lord sends something to me, it's good for me. And through this abhyasa, what you get is vairagya. And through abhyasa and vairagya, the mind can be stilled. Isn't that what we are trying to do? We are trying to tell the mind, behave yourself. When the heart is unobstructed, there is love. So we are trying to remove this obstruction of the mind. What are the ways of doing it? Either you teach the mind to pretend the heart, pretend like the heart, or you negate the mind, you remove the mind. But this has to be done only through this process. Because what did I say? The two qualities of the mind, self-preservation. If you suddenly just remove self-preservation, what happens? You become suicidal. I don't want to live. I don't care for this body. I don't care for my life. If you just remove self-preservation from there, the result is actually tragic. You become suicidal in nature. If you remove discrimination from the mind, you go crazy, right? There's no difference between good food, bad food. You'll be lying on the road. You become mad. But this has to be achieved through a practice, through a spiritual practice. And that becomes so possible and so easy when it comes to when you have love for the God, love for God. Many years ago, we were talking to one old devotee. He was a very, very well-off devotee, doing very well in his business. One day Swami looked at this devotee and kind of warned him. Swami said, a time will come when I'll take away all your wealth. A time will come when I'm going to take away all the luxuries and comforts you have. What do you say? And this man said, Swami, but whatever you do is going to be good for me. So if that is what you choose to do, you're welcome. The years passed, Swami did not say anything. So this person had a business, an international business. And one of his main markets was Sri Lanka, Ceylon then. Okay, about 25 to 35% of whatever he produced, he would export it to this place, Ceylon. One fine day what happened, the government came up with a policy. They said, we are importing too many things. Our manufacturing is not going up. So what do? Let's cut down on imports. So this particular product this man was producing, the Ceylon government said, we are not going to import it anymore. So imagine, overnight, his business is going to take a 40-50% fall. So he didn't know what to do. He came running to Swami. And he said, Swami, this is what has happened. Swami told him, don't worry. The Ceylon government is actually going to reinstate this import. After a few weeks, they'll review this decision and they'll say, we'll import. So what do? You go and produce those items. Don't worry. Because he came and asked, should I produce? Should I not produce? What should I do? Swami said, don't worry. Go ahead. Produce your 100%. Don't worry. So this man goes back to his hometown and he orders the factories, produce 100%, no problem. And just as Swami said, 2 weeks later, the Ceylon government again opened its imports. They said, okay, we have reviewed our decision, we'll open the imports. So this man was happy. 2 weeks later, again the Ceylon government reviewed its export-import policy and they said, we won't import. And by then, this man's factory has produced 100% of those goods. What to do? And that particular commodity which he was producing could not be stored for too long because it, especially in the rainy season, it gets spoiled. So again he came running to Swami. He said, Swami, this is what has happened. We've produced 100%. What do we do now? Swami said, is that so? You know what Swami said? Swami said, burn it up. Swami said, just burn it up. And this man went back home, went to his factories and ordered his men, just burn all the produce. He lost. You can imagine, he would have lost so much money in that. He came back to Swami next year and he said, Swami, I've done it. Swami said, okay, manchidi. The next year, again, Ceylon has to review its policy. The industry is waiting. Will they import? Will they not import? So this person again comes to Swami and he says, Swami, what do I do now? Swami says, produce 100%. This time Ceylon will import. Produce 100%. He says, okay, Swami, no questions. Swami, you said last time it didn't happen, nothing like that. Yes, Swami, we produce. Goes back, produce 100%. Ceylon government says, no imports. Comes back to Swami. Swami, what to do? I've produced. Burn it up. And he did this for not 1 year, not 2 years. He did it for 3 or 4 years together. Producing and burning, producing and burning. The management in his company lost faith in him. They said, this guy is going nuts. They started leaving him. The workers were getting the money, but he was selling all his property to sponsor this whim of his, producing and burning. And needless to say, he actually came to the streets after that. I don't know how many of you have read, there is this beautiful book called Guru Charitra. Just like how we have Satcharitra, which is about Shirdi Baba. This is Guru Charitra, it's about the incarnations of Dattatreya. Specifically, I think, Narsim Saraswati. In that, there is this story, there is this farmer who has his entire field, corn field, I think, corn or any, some particular grain like that. He has this field. And Shri Guru, that is how this incarnation of Dattatreya is referred to as, Shri Guru every day walks past this field and goes towards the river where he has this holy bath. This man is very devout. For some reason he has developed this intense love for Shri Guru. And every day when Shri Guru passes by, he walks up to him and does pranam to him and bows down to his feet. And the Shri Guru blesses him and goes away. And this man is a very happy man. His fields are always full and he's plentiful. He's actually a very small-time farmer who has made it big because of his hard work. And every day the Shri Guru passes, he offers his pranams and the Guru blesses him. One day when this Guru is passing by, he looks at the field and he tells this man, your field looks ready for harvest. This man looks at his field and he says, yes, it does look so. But it was a good 3 months before harvest time. The reality was the field was not ready for harvest. But the Guru is saying the field is ready for harvest. So this man says, yes, Guru, if you say it is ready. Then he tells him, will you harvest it now? And this man says, if you say so. So the Guru instructs him, I will go for my bath. By the time I come back, you should have finished the harvesting of your field. So this man says, yes, if you say so. 3 months before harvest time. The Guru goes, this man runs to the landlord, because he is still a farmer, he is not the landlord. And he tells the landlord, I want to harvest the crop in my field. He says, are you crazy? It's much before time. And this man says, I will give you twice your share. Permit me to do the harvest. I will bear whatever losses come. And he takes a written permission from the landlord and rushes towards the fields, calls his men and he says, harvest. The men says, what's wrong with you? Have you gone crazy? He says, nothing doing. I'll pay all of you whatever it's required. Go on and harvest. The wife and children come running. What are you doing? That's our food. He says, nothing doing. The Guru has told me to harvest. I'm going to harvest. So they harvest the whole thing. Everything is taken off. The landlord says, I can't do anything. He's taken my written permission. Then after all that, the Guru comes back and he sees the field is completely harvested. And he says, what's wrong with you? Why have you harvested? It's 3 months before time. This man says, Guru, you told me to do, I did it. The Guru says, good, and walks off. I'm definitely sure that all of you are keen to know what happened to that businessman and what happened to this farmer, right? What happened? I mean, he burnt all his produce, then what happened? This guy did his harvest, what happened? It is because we are always looking for that pleasant conclusion, our love is not perfect. Yes, we will do whatever Swami does, whatever Swami says, but somewhere at the back of the mind, there is this slight thought that what Swami does is good for me, so I'm waiting for the good to happen. So where is the good? Is that selfless love? Right? There is an imperfection even in this practice of telling whatever happens is good for me, isn't it? Because even when I tell you this story, I mean even when I read this story, so what is the conclusion? What happened to that man? I'm not going to tell you the conclusion, but Isn't that what which is troubling our mind? Because even when we say that love is doing without expectation, we have an expectation. Even when we say, tell Swami, Swami, whatever you say, I will do. But in the back of my mind, what am I getting? Okay, may not be today, may not be tomorrow, but sometime later, some punya later, hopefully there is a bank account where it is being stored. There is this joke which they say, imagine your amusement and wonder when you go up to heaven and find they don't have a record. Imagine your shock, you go to heaven and there is no record of your good and bad. How will you feel? Will we still do good when we believe that there is no record? There's this phenomenal story, I'm sure all of you must be knowing it like the back of your hand, but nevertheless, let's narrate it. One day, Lord Vishnu wakes up and he says, I'm having this splitting headache. You know, he's twirling and wincing in pain. He's not able to lie down. He's saying, I'm having this very bad headache. I don't know what to do. So his consort Lakshmi comes and everybody come and they're trying to assuage his pain. They try to give him all concoctions. Dhanavantri, the lord of medicine is called. He's not able to find a solution. And everybody is running helter-skelter and here is Lord Vishnu suffering with this unbearable headache. Then they send word to Narada, because Narada is a devotee. A devotee is closest to the Lord's heart. So he will know the solution. So Narada is called. So Narada comes and he is in pain to see his Lord in pain. So they finally say that, Lord, you tell me, what is the solution to this headache? Then Lord Vishnu says, that get the dust from the feet of my true devotee and apply it on my head. Then my headache will be gone. It's a simple solution. Whereas my true devotee, get the dust from the feet and apply it on my forehead. So Narada turns to Mother Lakshmi. He says, Mother, you're the one who gets the best opportunity to serve him, so you must be the closest devotee. Can you give the dust of your feet? So Lakshmi says, what do you mean? He is my lord. How can I put the dust of my feet on his forehead? I just cannot do that. And then she turns to Narada and says, Narada, but you are the real devotee. You're the devotee who is all the time thinking of the Lord. Give the dust of your feet. Narada says, how can I do that? I will rot in hell for ages to come if I take the dust of my feet and put it on the head of my Lord. How can I do that? It's blasphemy. So when the argument is going on, Lord Vishnu is still wincing in pain. And Vishnu is saying, what about my headache? Forget your resolution, what about my headache? So then they're not able to wonder, and then Lord Vishnu himself gives the solution. He says, go to Vrindavan. Ask the gopis. Ask if they are ready to part dust from their feet. So Narada is sent on the mission. Narada goes to Vrindavan. And there are these gopikas who are always thinking of the Lord. And he goes, and the story goes beautifully. Narada says, I'm coming from Vaikuntha. Your Lord Krishna, none other than Lord Vishnu, he's having a headache. The moment they hear that, some of them swoon into a faint. They can't imagine their Lord being in pain. And then they start praying and crying and asking Narada, what is the solution? Tell us, what can we do? And Narada very hesitantly says, that if you can give the dust of your feet, probably that will help. That's the solution which Lord Vishnu himself has given. Immediately one gopi runs, brings a huge blanket. They spread it out. All of them jump into it and they start dusting their feet. And Narada says, wait. Do you know the repercussions of the action that you're performing? And they say, what are the repercussions? I mean, the Lord's headache will be removed, isn't it? I mean, he said it will happen. He said, yes, that's definitely there. But do you know what will happen if you take the dust of your feet and put it on the Lord's head? And they ask, what will happen? You will rot for eons together in hell. And then the gopis ask, so? So what? The Lord's headache will go. So what if we rot for hundreds of years in hell? That is when Narada realizes what true devotion is. Swami, whatever you do is okay for me because whatever you do is good for me. Fine. Swami, whatever you do is okay for me. I don't go to the rest of the sentence. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what is good, what is wrong, whether it is good for me or not. I'm not even going to that part of the sentence. Swami, whatever you do is acceptable for me. Isn't that true love? When you say, whatever you do, whatever makes you happy, finished. End of the story. After making you happy, will I be happy or not? I don't mind. If you are happy, that is enough. That is why there are no conditions. All conditions are only in the mind. And when we can train this mind to be conditionless, this most classic story of Vivekananda, who is in pain, whose family is suffering, there's a lot of penury in his family. He goes to Ramakrishna, his guru, and he says, why don't you ask your mother? You talk to mother every day. Why don't you ask the mother for solution to my problem? And Ramakrishna asks, are you dumb? You can't speak? Why should I ask the mother on your behalf? The pain is yours, the family is yours. Why don't you ask? Why are you asking me to ask? Why are you asking me to mediate? So Vivekananda says, can I ask? Does she listen to me? She's the most compassionate. She listens to everybody. She's waiting to listen to you. She's just waiting for you to come and ask. So Vivekananda goes into the temple, the Kali temple. And he says, the moment he sees mother, all thoughts of the pain and suffering that his family is undergoing just vanishes. He looks at the mother and he says, mother, give me bhakti. He says, give me bhakti. Nothing more, give me bhakti. And he goes back. Then Ramakrishna comes and asks him, did you ask? And he says, oh God, I forgot. And Ramakrishna says, you forgot? You are in pain. Your mother is suffering. Your sisters and brothers are suffering. And you say, you forgot? How careless. He says, go and ask again. Again Vivekananda goes. And this time what does he ask? He says, mother, give me bhakti, give me vairagya and give me jnana. He says, give me bhakti, vairagya and jnana. He does not stop with bhakti. Because bhakti is fortified by jnana and vairagya. Vairagya is based upon bhakti and jnana. And the true expression of jnana is bhakti and vairagya. And this is what Swami says in his Jnana Vahini. He says these are like the Triveni. You cannot have one without the other. And if you have one without the one you have is not perfect. Always you have bhakti, jnana and vairagya together. That is why when I said, when you come to Swami, we are always coming because I love somebody else and I love myself. That's why when Krishna tells Arjuna there are four types of devotees, he says artha, artharthi, jignasu. You ask for money, you're a low-level devotee. You ask for solving problems of yourself and others, you're a low-level devotee. You ask for wisdom, you still are a low-level devotee because you're still asking for something for yourself. A jignasu is one who is after knowledge. Krishna says, even a jignasu is below. Only jnani is ultimate, and the jnani is a perfect devotee. There is no difference between perfect jnana and perfect prema. Probably I'll end with this one very interesting story. There is this kingdom where there is this star archer. You know, he's the best man archery in the kingdom and the kingdoms around. So one day he comes up to the court of the king and he says that I'm the best archer and I would like to display my talent, my ability. So the different things are done. You know, there is a target and he hits it. And there is a moving target, he hits it. There is a bird which is flying, he hits it. Seems to be the best archer. So then the king says, alright, I will give you a test. He says that here is my minister, and this minister is wearing a crown. Can you shoot the crown of my minister? This man says, yeah, that's no problem. You know, I can shoot a flying bird. Why can't I shoot the crown on a minister's head? then the king says, if you are able to do that, I will give you 1,000 gold coins. Right? I'll give you 1,000 gold coins if you're able to do that. If you don't do that, if you hit the minister by mistake, you know, off with your heads. Will you be able to shoot? And immediately the archer says, no, I can't. He says, no, I can't shoot now. He says, why? But you're the best archer and you showed your skills. You're so brilliant. He says, no, I can't. The king asks, why not? The archer says, my aim is perfect when I have one goal. My aim is perfect when I have only one goal in my mind. Till now, my target was only one. There was one target in front of me. You asked me to hit it. You can wake me up from my sleep. I'll hit it. Now you are placing two targets in front of me. Hit that target, save your life. Hit the target, win the gold. The moment there are two targets, my aim falters. In love, when there is your happiness and my happiness, there are two targets. When you say, I want to make you happy, I also want to be happy. I want to do what makes you happy, what gives you happiness. At the same time, I'm also seeking my happiness. There are two targets. The aim is perfect when there is one target. Love is perfect when there is only one target. And that is why this process of loving the Lord, that is why this process of trying to purify this love for the Lord, which is all in the mind, which is all in the mind, because your heart is perfect. We all, without our knowledge, are perfect devotees. But in this process of bringing out this perfection from within, you cannot help but dissolve this duality. You cannot help but reach that oneness. There is no different paths. That's why after giving all the wisdom of Advaita, Krishna says, but Arjuna, the best way to know me is through the path of love, is through the path of bhakti. It is only through bhakti you come to know me. It is only through bhakti you come to love me. And that is what it is to be loved unconditionally. We all know what it is to be loved unconditionally, whether we believe it or not. We all have been objects of that unconditional love. I think it's just the turn to return it, because that's what makes the journey complete. This is what I had to say. I might have said something maybe incomplete, but probably these are points which we follow, we may find completeness. I most humbly offer this talk at Bhagwan's Lotus Feet, and I thank all of you for your very, very patient listening.